Chapter 1 Urun hated gems more than she had ever hated anything. No, that wasn't true. She hated the mine boss more than she hated gems. And she hated the Memluk guards, and the mining wield who had sent her to die in this death hole they called Devil's Crown. Her lantern flickered, momentarily turning the pocket of cave black. Bogging hell, she was almost out of fire moss. Another day returning empty-handed. Another day being beaten or dangled over the cliff while the mine boss screamed for the guards to drop her. Only now they finally would. Urun swung her pick one last time, saying a prayer to the great sky, an utterly pointless act, so far underground. The shock of metal against stone reverberated through her as her pick cleaved into the wall, shattering the rock. And there, as if she had willed it, was the vein. A jagged line of white stone, like fat cutting through mutton. She held her breath and swung again, sending a shower of rocks to the floor. As they fell, a blue flash caught in the light. Urun's hands were so cramped, she had to pry them off the pick's handle to pluck the rough gem from the rubble. The crystal was hardly bigger than the tip of her pinky finger, its planes the soft blue of a summer evening. Urun let out the breath she'd been holding. Maybe her prayer had been heard after all. As fast as the hope filled her, it drained back out, like a bucket with a hole. If the sky cared about the prayers of a goat herder, she wouldn't still be here. She turned the blue stone over in her palm, relieved and annoyed. Where there was one gem, there would be more, and the more gems the mining wield found, the more Memluks they could afford to invade innocent lands like her own. Urun tucked the blue crystal under her tongue before she could lose it. Some sort of sea fire, maybe. Though whether it was a valuable vagary or just a forget-me-not, she couldn't say. Her family were gem-shy. They didn't believe in using rocks to solve the problems, not unless it involved a sling and a yoti. The people of the Sky Country still followed the way. Not like the lazy, spoiled, bug-eating Asterians, using gems to ease and cheat their way through life. It made her blood seethe to know she was risking her life just because some vain northerner wanted violet eyes instead of blue or couldn't remember their grocery list without a gem aid. But as quickly as her rage came, it fell away again, too heavy for her tired body to hold. Urun rocked her head from one shoulder to the other. After the long cold hours, crawling through the damp labyrinth of caves, that cut through the mine, her muscles had forgotten whether they were stone or flesh. In the lantern's low light, she looked more like an old woman than a girl, her dark eyes sunken, her back stooped, her skin as light as butter tea after so many months in the dark. Still stiff, she collected her pack and tools, then followed the chalk marks that would lead her back out, the second lesson the other ratters had taught her when she had first arrived. Mark your escape. The light flickered again. Crap on crap. The first lesson was not to run out of fire moss. After filling her lantern with nearly the last of the fuel, she squeezed herself out the hole she'd come in, spidering her way between long spikes of rock that met between floor and ceiling, like a giant's bite. The scent of wet rock guided her toward a gaping chasm. Two towers, twisting upward from the center like frozen lovers, cursed mid-embrace. Urun didn't believe in eye-eyes and peskies, but if there were any place in the mine that spirits might dwell, it would be here in this bottomless darkness. She circled the chasm's edge, toes gripping like fingers, until she reached a fan of ham-colored crystal marked with chalk. She swung herself over it and into a vertical chute, startling a bat from sleep, its soft wing brushing against her cheek as it flapped off. Urun wished she too had wings to fly away. Lantern clamped between her teeth, she felt her way down the rock chimney, wedging elbows and knees out as anchors as she stretched to find her next toehold. At the bottom, she landed in a tunnel so full of rubble she could touch the ceiling. From there, it was a matter of crossing the loose boulders without one turning and crushing her. The trick was to move either very fast or very slow. At the end of the tunnel was a wooden barricade, an X of rotting wood, marked with skulls, warning other miners away from the closed floor. Ratters were not so lucky. Not even the last ratter. She was still Rabu. Still one of the damned. If she died, it would be a mere inconvenience to the men that ran the mine, just as it was when the other ratters died. The faces of her dead friends came back to Arund as if they stood before her. Pitt, Aang, Laura, all gone. Arund shook her head as if it might clear the ghosts away. Grief was a distraction the mountain would not forgive. Her lantern hissed, almost out of fuel. Arund cursed, slipping beneath the blockade and into the main tunnel. Stin, the Asterian in charge of ratters, was nowhere to be seen. It wasn't the first time he had left her. Perhaps the man thought she wasn't coming back, fallen down a crevasse, or stuck in a hole, or suffocated by cave gas. There were countless ways to die underground, and the bones of dead ratters to prove it. More likely, though, he had snuck off for a game of keeps with one of the Memlooks. The ex-pirates nearly always preferred gambling to working. Unless working meant violence, that they enjoyed. Had it been earlier, Arund would have taken a nap, but her shift would be ending soon, and she had to hurry if she wanted dinner. Then, a new thought occurred to her. Without Stin, there was no one to watch her on the walk back to camp. Without Stin, there was no one to watch she didn't slip away. She and Pitt had talked many times about escaping. It was too late for her friend now. But not for her. Arund began to run, following the tunnel's convoluted path upward, skidding around corners. She pulled herself up the rusty spikes that served as a ladder, ignoring her usual curiosity about how the mining wheel had ever gotten so much heavy equipment here with the light airships. One tunnel gave way to another as she raced up the mine's floors. She could just smell the first drafts of fresh air when her lantern blew out. Bogging fire moss! Arund reached for the walls, just as Pitt had taught her, counting the turns back. Left, left, right, duck, left, left, right, left. Her pack bounced against her spine as she ran through the mountain. Right, left, right again. She knew the way out as if it were painted in her mind. A gong sounded in the distance, starting off a cascade of bells. Right, left, left. A torch sputtered in the tunnel ahead. She would miss dinner, such as it was, but that didn't matter now. If she really ran away, she would probably miss many meals in the days ahead. The light increased and other workers appeared, dark silhouettes in the shadowy tunnel. Arund squeezed past the trudging prisoners, only slowing when she passed a guard. In the entrance chamber, she unpacked her sack of tools, then pushed her way through the stinking bodies to the large map drawn across a flat wall. With a nub of chalk, she added a mark where she'd found the vein, then erased it, then put it back. It pained her to help the mining wheel find a single gem, but she couldn't risk a beating now. As one line of prisoners stumbled out of the mountain into the night, heads hanging, another shift of men and women shuffled in, past Brandel, the mine boss. The slope-shouldered Asterian perched on a rock outside the entrance, too absorbed with a mottled green crystal he wore around his neck to even look up. The amulet hung from a long silver chain, bright against the mine boss's coat, a garment so stained the golden eagle of the mining wheel was barely visible. Without his gems, he might have been mistaken for one of the Rabu. He was as dirty as his prisoners, the nails at the ends of his ringed fingers black with dirt, his posture bent from hours of looking at small jewels. Arund despised him. The only man in camp with a bath barrel, and he never used it. His hair was dark with grease, his skin a sour yellow. Pitt had said it was a side effect of the short-handled strikers at his belt. Ornately engraved, gem-powered weapons that could spit lightning like venom. In front of the mine boss, was a dented metal ball, worn smooth with handling.
Well?
Brandel asked, letting the amulet drop back against his chest. Prisoners who had not yet turned in any gems they had found during their shift had one last chance. Rune pulled the small blue stone from under her tongue and dropped it with a clatter on top of a half dozen others. Brandel snatched the gem back out before it had even settled, tilting it one way, then the other, in the light of the lantern, his mouth open slightly.
You found the vein? In the caves?
His bloodshot eyes, already large, grew wider as they shifted from the stone to Irund.
Did you put it on the map?
Irund motioned toward the entrance chamber. Of course she had.
So, I was right.
With a flick, Brandel tossed the blue gem back. Not a precious vagary, then. He would have set that aside.
You should have listened to me before.
That was a lie. Irund hated liars. It had been Stin's idea for Irund to search the caves. The mine boss had been against it.
Where's Stin?
Irund shrugged. She wasn't the Memlook's keeper.
Useless mute,
said the mine boss, scratching at his pants. Useless bugnuts, Irund thought right back. She wasn't mute. She just didn't have anything to say. What was the point? Talking and crying were the two things that annoyed her captors the most. So she did neither. Pitt was the last person Irund had spoken with. He taught her everything when she'd first arrived. The correct way to swing a pick, and how to use the color of the bedrock to find the gem-bearing vein. He had reminded her of her cousins, full of jokes at the guard's expense. Now he was gone, swallowed up by the mountain, along with all the other ratters, all except her.
Then tomorrow you'll blast.
Brandel picked up the mottled green stone that lay in front of him, rubbing it with his thumb. Blast! Bile splashed up behind Rune's ribs.
What's that? Do you wish to say something, Rabu?
Rune's teeth cut into her lips as she forced her mouth shut.
It's too bad there's no one to help you. Perhaps if you had done your job last time, your friends might still be alive.
Rune's fists squeezed tight. It was the mine boss that had given the orders to blast beneath an unstable floor.
Well, such was their way. Don't cry. I thought you sheep-eaters liked blowing things up.
Irund wasn't crying. She was imagining plunging her thumbs through the Asterion's eyeballs. Brandel waved the next prisoner forward. Irund was dismissed. Fists still balled, she got back in line. Her family had never touched the bridge over the Jaggedy River, whatever the wheel said. But they had paid anyway. For the thousandth time, her mind wandered over the night of her capture, trying to find the chink where it had all gone wrong. The moment that, if she had just seen it, the horror could be undone. The day had been warm and the grazing good, so she and her cousins had taken their time returning from the upper pasture, while the suns lingered on the dusty pink horizon. It was after twilight by the time she had herded her sheep into their pens, the stars pricking through the sky one by one. Inside, her little sisters were already getting into their beds. As always, her grandmother sat by the stove in the center of the room, telling them a story. Irund greeted her with a kiss, her cheek like soft leather beneath her lips. The scent of dinner still lingered in the round house.
Ooh, you made dumplings!
Her mother's curd dumplings were famous, their edges fried to a crisp in mutton fat, then sprinkled with browned onion.
Watch your boots,
warned her mother in her quiet voice.
You're getting mud on the rugs. And take off your father's hat before you lose it. It's as big as a bucket on you,
she said, filling Irund a bowl of butter tea. Irund pulled off her felt boots, but stubbornly left the wide-brimmed hat on as she knelt at the low table in front of the stove. Her father was away trading, and she missed him. "You're very late tonight," observed her mother.
"Are they running out of forage so soon? Maybe you should try going east tomorrow."
"There's plenty of grass still," Rune inhaled as her mother filled a plate with warm dumplings and fried onions and set it in front of her.
"That means you are racing your cousins. You cannot watch the herd if you are running to Tala and back again, Yurund."
The dogs were still watching, and,
"Mama, Otur's new horse is so fast. You should see how he flies."
She picked up a dumpling. Her mother was not listening, but had held up a finger.
"I think I heard the gate. Go check, Yurund, and make sure it hasn't come open. I put a batch of cheese out to dry this afternoon, and I don't want those dogs in it."
Urun groaned. She hadn't even had a bite yet.
"I shut the gate tight and put the wire over."
Her mother's head tipped ever so slightly back as her arms crossed.
"But it won't hurt to go and look,"
said Urun hastily, setting the warm dumpling back down. Outside, she shut the thick blue door behind her and waited for her eyes to adjust to the moonless night. Without a sound, a gloved hand closed around her mouth. Urun tried to scream, but the grip was too tight. Something soft was crammed between her teeth, and a musty bag dropped over her head. Rough ropes wound around her ankles and arms, and then chaos. Dogs barking and yelping, her sister screaming, her cousins and uncle shouting from next door to run, run. But it was too late. Urun forced herself to breathe as she came back to the present. She wished they had blown up the mining wheel's bogging bridge. Yet now was not the time for revenge. Let the mine boss say what he wanted. She was leaving, and soon, before they realized the missing stin meant no one was watching her. Up ahead, a loud woof of air escaped a prisoner as he collapsed to the ground, the fist of a giant Memluk guard suspended over him. Another Memluk hauled him back up, and they continued the nightly search, within the circle of torches, outside the mine's entrance. First, they parted the man's hair, then peered into his ears, looked up his dust-inflamed nostrils, under his tongue, and on down the length of his entire body. The prisoners wore little except a threadbare sarong and menacing silver snake bracelets around each wrist. There were few things as hotly traded in camp as an article of clothing. They'd been provisioned, if it could be called that, for the sweltering heat of the mesmerald mines of Smeraldus. Then, with no explanation, the wheel's airships had veered south instead of north, to the snow-covered peaks of the high Ares, where a sarong was no match for the towering mountain's ill-tempered weather. Soon, it was Arun's turn to be searched. She stood in the circle of light, amusing the Memluks when they lifted her skinny arms to see underneath, and she came right off the ground. One of the Memluks made a joke in Dwar, the gargling, bone-crunching tongue of the guards from across the long sea. The men were captives themselves, prizes of the ongoing spice wars, and much valued by the wheels for their size and fierceness. The large Memluk thumped Rune's head playfully, making her ears ring. His grin was interrupted by a pink scar that jagged from temple to mouth, just missing a thick red beard, woven with jewels the colors of a storm-cast sea. She'd heard the other Memluks call him Melmeth, but Arun thought of him as Gembeard. Trails of tattoo sailboats looped around his son's darkened wrists and neck, merging seamlessly with the embroidered islands and coastlines on his leather vest. His chest was a tangle of stone amulets, and more talismans hung from his broad belt, which was overloaded with clanking weapons and tools, including a broad and deadly-looking hammer as long as Yurun's arm. On his feet were the largest boots she'd ever seen, made of fur and hide and hammered discs of metal, dagger hilts glinting from the tops. Seeing Arun didn't understand his joke, Gembeard flapped his arms, cocking his head in and out like a chicken. Arun could tell she was being insulted, whatever the language. You could feed us more, she wanted to scream. But the guards didn't speak the language of her people. They didn't even speak trade tongue. Too stupid to learn, no doubt. Not that the Memluks seemed to have any desire to converse with the Rabu they were in charge of. Not when a shove would do. Pitt had tried to explain the hierarchy of Asteria's prisoners, mercenaries and servants to Arund once. It was nearly as confounding as a system of wheels, which controlled everything from mining to sewers. Ratters weren't supposed to talk. But with most of their shifts spent deep in the crevices of the mine where no adults fit, there had been no one to stop them. Jembeard clucked some more, braids waggling, then went on with his job, prying apart Arun's fingers to see if a small rubily or moonstone had been secreted between them. An involuntary complaint escaped her when the rough hands moved onto her feet. She sucked the sound back.
You won't laugh when we cut off your toes and make you eat them because you tried to steal one of the wheel's gems,
threatened Brandel as he stopped to watch on his way back to camp. The gems in his bowl had been emptied into a worn leather pouch that hung from his neck beside his other talismans.
Don't forget the ears,
he reminded the guards. When the Memluks ignored him, he said it again in Dwar. The men turned to stare him down, each twice his size. The mine boss had the slack muscles of one who had others to his bidding. His jeweled hand moved to one of the strikers on his belt, but the guards did not break eye contact. They knew he wouldn't shoot them. They were too valuable. The scarred Memluk fainted forward. Brandel retreated.
Carry on, then,
he commanded from the safer distance. With a smirk, the men returned to their task. The mine boss slapped a man that made the mistake of being within reach and stomped down the valley toward his tent, where he would spend the rest of the night counting and recounting piles of raw gems. The Memluks continued their search, not forgetting to check Irun's short hair or under her snake-shaped anklets. She'd been too small for her captors to fit the scaled manacles around her wrists. The first day they'd been put on at the Rabu market in Wynn, she tried to pull them off, but the resulting jolt had been so strong it had knocked her over. Now she touched the anklets with her unblinking jeweled eyes as rarely as possible, though the cold metal made her legs ache. The other prisoners watched from under their bowed heads while the Memluks pulled on Arun's ears to peer inside. They all knew the penalty for stealing a gem from Devil's Crown. The skulls of previous thieves had been turned into lanterns to remind them. Satisfied, Jembeard pushed Arund out of the circle of light. Arund blinked at the sudden dark. Two faintly glowing ribbons lined the trail down the mountain's side, switching back and forth toward the camp of tents pitched between piles of tailings and trash in the valley below. Arun stopped along the darkest part of the trail, where the echo of the river beneath the cliffs blotted out the sounds of men, and she was alone with the stars. She had spent many nights back home, gazing up at the constellations while out with her goats. The sky country was aptly named, with its high plains and long views, while at Devil's Crown, the heavens were reduced to a meager bowl between snowy peaks. Bracing against the wind, Arun searched the eastern horizon for her favorite constellation, the Kite, barely visible in the east, its starry string hidden by the mass of mountains. To the west, wisps of cloud furled like sails around the great ship before they blew on. Once again, Arun willed the tiny specks of light to reverse time and return her to where she belonged. But the stars ignored her, blind to anything but their own light. Tomorrow you'll blast, the words repeated in Arun's head as she dropped her gaze to the glowing ropes beside the trail. The one bordering the cliff was as thin as a pinky finger, its greenish light wan. Deadlines, the Rabu called them, though they didn't look deadly to Arun. Clever, perhaps, with their mysterious luminous fibers. The Asterians were nothing if not clever. But deadly? No. That was just what the Weald wanted them to believe. The real reason nobody ever crossed the ropes was because of what lay on the other side. For beyond the deadlines, beyond the ragged cliffs and the rushing river, still loomed the peaks of Devil's Crown, sharp as blades, their dizzying crests disappearing into the clouds, impassable without an airship, like the ones that had brought them. Impassable for most, maybe, but Arund had spent her life scaling rocky crags with her goats. She took a small step toward the edge, checking the sky once more for her bearings. The sky country couldn't be more than 1,000 miles from here. She could be there by summer. After all, her family were nomads. Travel was her birthright. Even uncaring, the stars would still guide her. Though the journey would not be entirely straight. To the east, the direction of her home, lay the salt lands, a flat expanse with neither water nor trees. To the north, stretched the Gem Road, with its regular patrols of Weald men and bandits. And to the south was a land of storms, full of wolves and woodwilds. At least, that was what the other ratters had said. Arund was afraid of wolves, but not woodwilds. They were no more real than eye-eyes and peskies. She took another step, the wind whistling through her sarong, pushing her onward. No one would even notice she was gone. Not until her next shift. Tomorrow you'll blast. Arund made up her mind. She was going home, deadlines be damned. With a thrill of exhilaration, she lifted her foot for the last step to freedom.
Nope, you don't.
An enormous hand yanked her back by the neck.
Stop your kicking or I'll throw you over, see if I don't.
Arund dangled in midair for a long moment before being tossed onto the trail.
Son of the sea, mother, you really are an idiot.
The moon's light outlined the pinkish-white scar running down Jembeard's face.
Thought for sure it was going to be one of those Lumi that went first.
His accent was so thick, the Memlook sounded more like he was growling than speaking trade tongue.
You could have cost me a nice little moony stone,
Jembeard went on, wagging a big finger at her.
I didn't bet on no scrawny chickens.
So, the Memlooks had a wager going over which prisoner would escape first. She should have known. Those idiots would bet on anything and everything, from how far they could spit to who had the biggest knife. Arund glared up at the guard, the disappointment so bitter she could taste it in her mouth. All she wanted was to go home, back to her goats and her pony and the scrub-covered hills, back to being a child. Back to the arms of her family. Arund lifted her face up to the sky, wondering why it had abandoned her. As if to taunt her, the clouds parted to reveal the wild mare bucking and sparkling against the night.
What the sea snakes are you looking at? The bringers back?
The bringers. Those mythical beings whose boats could fly between the stars. Superstitious Memlooks. Arund looked for the horsefly constellation behind the mare's tail.
What are you always looking at the blooding sky for? Is it the stars?
Jembeard pushed Arund down the hill toward camp.
Can't eat stars, you know.
Arund's stomach grumbled its agreement, but her eyes lingered on the twinkling bits of light the Wheels of Asteria had yet to claim.